There's a kind of wound we almost never admit out loud. The one that doesn't come from enemies, but from the people who share our last name. We feel it before every visit. Our phone lights up with their name and our chest tightens. We sit outside the house in the car a little too long, rehearsing how to act. We unlock the door, step inside, and we can feel it immediately. We are not fully ourselves here. We switch into the good version. We swallow what we really think. We say, "It's fine, they're family." While something inside us screams, "No, it's not fine, not anymore." We know the phrases by heart. "We sacrificed everything for you. We just want what's best for you. You're breaking the family." And every time we hear them, it feels less like love and more like a knife wrapped in a hug. Underneath the words, we hear the real message. You don't belong to yourself, you belong to us. So we stop choosing what we want. We start choosing whatever keeps the peace. We're not living, we're managing their reactions. That's when love starts to feel like a contract. Respect means obedience. Being a good son or daughter means slowly deleting ourselves so everyone else can stay comfortable. We laugh at their jokes, nod at their opinions, play our assigned role at the table, and then later, in our bed or on the way home, the anger hits. Not anger at them, anger at us. At how small we let ourselves become. At how often we abandon our own soul just to avoid being called ungrateful. Here's the truth we've been too scared to say, even in our own head. Family is not ownership. Shared blood does not give anyone the right to control our choices, rewrite our identity, or sit inside our mind like a permanent judge. Love is not supposed to feel like surveillance. Care is not supposed to feel like leverage. The moment we love you becomes we own you, it stops being love. It becomes control. This episode is not about burning everything down. It's about finally drawing a line inside. We will not keep destroying ourselves to keep the family story intact. We will not keep calling it love when it feels like a cage. We're here to protect our soul without apology. To understand that boundaries are not betrayal. They are the first honest act of self-respect. So in this conversation, we're going to name 10 specific boundaries we will no longer allow family to cross around our mind, our emotions, our money, our future. Boundaries that say clearly and calmly, we can love you deeply and still refuse to let you own us. And we start with the first one. The moment we stop believing that family equals control, the ownership illusion. 1. The ownership illusion. The first boundary we have to draw is against an illusion that we've inhaled since childhood. The idea that because we come from a family, we somehow belong to it more than we belong to ourselves. That our body, our time, our choices, our future, are all partially family property. We feel it in the small comments. In this family, we don't do that. What will people say about us? You can't live like this. You're one of us. It sounds like identity, but it acts like ownership. And somewhere along the way, we start to move through life as if we're not a person first. We're a role first. The good child, the quiet one, the responsible one, the one who always picks up the phone, always says yes, always sacrifices their own path to keep the family script intact. If we're honest with ourselves, we know how heavy that feels. We say, "I'm going to visit my family," but what we really mean is, "I'm going back into the version of myself they're comfortable with." We edit what we say. We downplay what we want. We hide parts of who we are because we've learned, through years of subtle reactions, what is acceptable and what is too much. And then we wonder why we feel like strangers in our own life. We're not just carrying a last name, We're carrying a silent contract. Don't embarrass us. Don't outgrow us. Don't choose yourself in a way that makes us uncomfortable. The ownership illusion works like this. We raised you, therefore we get a say in who you become. On the surface, it can look like care, advice, concern. But if we listen carefully, we can hear when it crosses the line. It's not, what do you really want? It's, here's what you should do. It's not, we're proud of you for thinking for yourself. It's, after everything we did, you're going to choose that. The message underneath is clear. Your life is not fully yours. Your identity is a family project. You are an extension, not an individual. Breaking that illusion doesn't mean we stop loving our family. It means we stop surrendering our ownership of ourselves. We start from a simple truth. We belong to ourselves first. Our mind is ours. Our values are ours. Our boundaries are ours. We can honor where we came from without letting it dictate where we're allowed to go. We can feel gratitude without turning that gratitude into a lifetime of obedience. And we can love deeply without letting that love be used as a leash. So we quietly shift the center of gravity. Instead of asking, what will they think if I do this? We begin asking, what happens to me if I keep ignoring what I really want? Instead of assuming family has automatic access to every part of us, we begin treating access as something that is earned through respect, not granted by default. We stop apologizing inside our own head for wanting a life that reflects who we are, not just where we came from. This is the first boundary. We are not possessions. We are not extensions. We are not emotional property to be managed. We can love our family and still reclaim the simple, powerful truth that our life, in the end, is ours. 2. The debt narrative. The second boundary is against a story we've heard in a thousand different forms. We sacrificed everything for you. The moment those words land, our existence starts to feel like it comes with a bill. Suddenly, it's not just our life anymore. It's a repayment plan. Every decision, every choice, every step forward has to be justified against that invisible debt. After everything they did, do we really have the right to choose differently? We're told this is love. We're told this is gratitude. But somewhere deeper, we can feel the difference between genuine love and emotional leverage. Real love says, we did this because we wanted you to have a better life. Debt love says, we did this, so now your life belongs to us. One frees us. The other slowly locks us in. When sacrifice is pure, it doesn't need to be repeated like a slogan. It doesn't show up in every argument, every disagreement, every moment where we try to set a boundary. But when it becomes a tool of control, it's always right there, waiting to be used. We hear, you know what we gave up for you. Right at the moment, we're about to choose something for ourselves. We hear, you're selfish, the second we say no. And without even noticing, we stop asking me what is right for us and start asking me what will keep everyone else from feeling disappointed. That's how the debt narrative works. It takes something beautiful, sacrifice, and turns it into a lifetime invoice. It tells us that we don't get to fully own our successes, our happiness, our independence, because all of it is tied to what someone else did in the past. And if we're not careful, we end up living in a permanent state of apology, apologizing for growing, for changing, for wanting more, for not giving our entire future back as a thank you for the past. But here's the truth we need to sit with, even if it feels uncomfortable at first. We did not ask to be born. We did not sign a contract as children agreeing to repay every hour, every dollar, every sacrifice with our identity. parenting, caretaking, support. These are acts of love, not investments with guaranteed emotional returns. Gratitude is something we choose from the heart. Obligation is something we're pressured into from the outside. And the more we confuse the two, the more we lose ourselves. We can appreciate everything that was done for us and still refuse to live as if we're in debt forever. Those two things can exist at the same time. We can say, "Thank you for what you gave," without accepting the unspoken part. So now, you get to decide who we become. We can show kindness, help, support, and presence, not because we owe, but because we genuinely want to give. That's what real gratitude looks like when it's healthy, voluntary, not coerced. So we start to question the script in our own mind. Every time we feel guilty for making a choice that aligns with our well-being, we pause and ask, are we actually doing something wrong? Or are we just breaking a pattern where our life was never really ours in the first place? Every time we hear that sentence, "We sacrificed everything for you," we can acknowledge the truth in it without accepting the hidden message. Yes, they gave. Yes, there was effort, struggle, maybe pain. And also, our existence is not alone. We belong to ourselves, even if other people helped us get here. Our future is not a refund. Our happiness is not a receipt. If sacrifice is real, it doesn't need to chain us. It should liberate us. The healthiest way to honor what was done for us is not by staying small to keep everyone else comfortable, but by actually living well, by becoming whole, by choosing a life that reflects our values, not just their fears. So we quietly draw a new line inside. We will no longer let sacrifice be used as a weapon against our choices. We will no longer allow every boundary, every dream, every step of independence to be labeled as ingratitude. We can remember where we came from without letting that memory turn into a lifetime of emotional debt. And if guilt still shows up, we can look it in the eye and remind ourselves. Gratitude is something we feel and express freely. Obligation is something we're forced into. We are allowed to choose the first and refuse the second. 3. Fear disguised as protection. There's a kind of sentence we hear a lot in families that sounds caring on the surface but feels heavy underneath. We're just worried about you. We don't want you to get hurt. We're only trying to protect you. And the strange thing is, every time we hear it, something inside us shrinks a little. Not because protection is bad, but because we can feel that what's being protected is not our well-being, it's their fear. When we look closely, a lot of what gets called family wisdom is really generational anxiety in a nicer outfit. Don't start that business, it's too risky. Don't move to that city, it's far from us. Don't end that relationship, you'll regret it. On the surface, it sounds like guidance, but the pattern is always the same. Stay close, stay small, stay familiar. And we start to realize the boundary we need to draw here is simple and hard at the same time. Their fears do not get to define our future. It helps to remember where this comes from. Our parents, our relatives, they carry their own scars, their own failures, their own disappointments. Maybe they tried something once and it broke them. Maybe they grew up in scarcity and still live like everything might disappear tomorrow. Maybe they were shamed for wanting more, so they learned to call playing safe being realistic. And without even knowing it, they hand that fear down like an heirloom. We're only telling you this because we love you. The problem is that fear, when it's disguised as love, becomes very hard to challenge. We start to feel selfish for wanting something bigger. We ask ourselves, are we reckless? Are we ungrateful? Are we naive? So we stay in the job we've outgrown. We stay in the relationship that quietly kills us. We stay in the version of life that makes them sleep better at night, while we lie awake wondering what would have happened if we'd just taken the risk. The line we have to draw here is not between love and family. It's between love and control. Genuine protection says, "Here are the risks I see. I trust you to decide." Projected fear says, "Here are the risks I see. So you're not allowed to decide." One respects our autonomy, the other quietly erases it. We can start by noticing how we feel during these conversations. Do we come away feeling clearer or more confused, supported or smaller? Do we feel like we've just been offered perspective or like we've been subtly warned back into our place? Our body usually tells the truth before our mind does. Once we see it, we can respond differently inside ourselves, even if we don't argue on the outside. When we hear, "Don't do that, it's too dangerous," we can translate it in our own mind. They're scared because of their experiences. That fear belongs to them, not to us. When we hear, "You'll regret this," we can quietly answer, "We trust ourselves enough to face the consequences of our own choices." This doesn't mean we ignore every warning. Sometimes there is genuine wisdom buried under the anxiety, things we hadn't thought of, blind spots we need to see. The boundary isn't "never listen." The boundary is, we will listen, but we will not let borrowed fear become our prison. We're allowed to step into futures our family is afraid of. We're allowed to outgrow their version of safety. We're allowed to want a life that looks nothing like what they imagined when we were children. That's not disrespect. That's responsibility for our own one life. So the next time fear shows up dressed as protection, we can breathe, feel the pull, and still choose our path. We can say, out loud or silently, "I hear you. I understand that you're afraid, and I'm still going to live this life as mine." Because if we let their fear make every decision, we don't avoid pain. We just guarantee a different kind of pain, the pain of never finding out who we could have been. And that's a cost we don't have to keep paying. 4. Emotional access is a privilege. The fourth boundary we need to draw is around something we've been taught to give away too easily: access to our inner world. Because somewhere along the way, we absorbed the idea that if someone is family, they automatically have the right to know everything: what we feel, what we think, who we love, what we fear, what we dream about at 3 in the morning when everything feels fragile. And if we ever pull back, if we ever become more private, the accusations come quickly. "You've changed. You're hiding things. You don't trust us anymore." But the truth we've been avoiding is this: emotional access is not a birthright. It's a privilege, and a privilege must be earned, not demanded. We know how it feels when we open up and regret it, when we share something vulnerable, a dream, a doubt, a heartbreak, and later find it turned into gossip, a weapon in an argument, or a story they retell with a tone that makes us feel small. The next time we want to speak honestly, something in us tightens. We hesitate, we think twice, and then we judge ourselves for becoming distant, when in reality, we're just responding to the evidence. It wasn't safe. We need to give ourselves permission to believe what our experience is showing us. If our honesty keeps coming back to hurt us, the solution is not "share more and be stronger." The solution is step back and be wiser. Love does not mean giving someone unlimited access to our heart, no matter how they use it. Love can exist side by side with discretion. We belong to ourselves first, and that includes our emotional life. We are allowed to ask, "Who has shown us they can hold our feelings gently? Who has shown us they can disagree with us without mocking us?" Who listens without turning every confession into evidence against us later? Those are the people who earn deeper access. Not the ones who demand it by saying, "But we're your family." We don't owe anyone our emotional nakedness. Not a parent, not a sibling, not a relative who thinks their age gives them the right to cross every line. We can be respectful, warm, even loving, and still choose what we keep for ourselves, or for the very few who have proven they can handle it with respect. That doesn't mean we become cold or closed off. It means we become intentional. We stop oversharing into unsafe spaces and then wondering why we feel exposed. We start treating our inner world like something valuable, not public property. We can share selectively, slowly, with those who show us through their behavior, not their words, that they can be trusted with our truth. So the boundary here is simple but powerful. No one gets automatic access to our deepest thoughts and feelings just because they helped raise us or share our blood. Emotional access must match emotional safety. If someone mocks our vulnerability, uses our secrets as leverage, or punishes our honesty, we are allowed to step back. We are allowed to say less. We are allowed to protect what is still tender in us. We're not cold for doing that. We're not dramatic. We're finally understanding that our inner world is not a family living room where anyone can walk in, sit down, and rearrange things. It's our space, our responsibility, our choice. And from now on, we choose to give that access carefully, consciously, and only where our dignity is safe. 5. Money does not equal ownership. The fifth boundary we have to draw is around one of the most powerful tools of control inside families: money, help, support, a loan, a house, a ticket, school fees. All of that can start as generosity and slowly transform into a chain. And we don't always notice when it happens. We just wake up one day and realize that every time we try to make a decision, we hear a silent reminder in the background. Remember who paid for that. When money is healthy, it's an expression of care. We wanted to help you get started. We didn't want you to struggle alone. It creates space, reduces pressure, opens doors. But when money becomes a tool of control, the energy changes. The sentence stops being, "We helped because we love you," and starts sounding more like, "We helped you, so now your life is subject to our approval." The support didn't disappear, but our freedom did. We feel it in the way conversations shift. We mention a choice we want to make, and suddenly we're reminded of bills, tuition, a down payment, a transfer. After everything we've spent on you, this is what you're going to do. The message underneath is clear. Our money bought a vote in your decisions, and if we're not careful, we start believing it. We start acting as if financial help automatically includes moral authority. But here's the truth we need to say to ourselves clearly, even if we never say it out loud to them. Support is generosity, not ownership. Helping with money doesn't give anyone the right to manage our soul. A transfer into our bank account is not a signature on our identity. If someone chooses to give, that choice is theirs. What we do with our life is ours. That doesn't mean we act entitled or ungrateful. We can appreciate every act of help. We can acknowledge the weight it carried. We can feel genuine gratitude. The boundary isn't against help. The boundary is against leveraging that help forever. Because when every visit, every phone call, every disagreement is haunted by the memory of who paid for what, we're not in a relationship anymore, we're in a contract. We also have to be honest with ourselves. Sometimes we accept money because it feels easier in the moment, and we ignore the price that comes with it. The constant advice, the subtle interference, the unspoken expectation that we will now live a version of life that keeps the investor happy. So part of this boundary is practical. If we don't want people to feel entitled to own our choices, we have to be very careful about what kind of financial strings we allow into our life. We're allowed to say no to money that comes with invisible chains. We're allowed to choose a smaller apartment, a cheaper car, a slower path, if that means we keep our autonomy. We're allowed to decide that peace of mind is worth more than a gift that never stops talking. And if we are already in this dynamic, already receiving help, already hearing the reminders, we can start by setting a boundary inside. We stop translating "I helped you" into "I own you." We remind ourselves quietly, "They chose to give, and I chose to receive. That does not erase my right to choose my own life." If guilt shows up, we can feel it without letting it steer the wheel. We can also move step by step toward more independence. Not from pride, but from clarity. Maybe we start taking on more responsibility. Maybe we plan to pay back what we can, not because we must, but because it helps us reclaim our sense of equality. Maybe we simply stop justifying every decision as if we're on trial for misuse of funds. The boundary here is simple to name and hard to live. Their money does not buy our identity. Their support does not grant them permanent access to our choices. We can honor the help without surrendering the right to decide who we become. We are not a family investment portfolio. We are human beings with one life. And from now on, we are allowed to protect that life, even if it means saying no to support that feels more like a leash than a gift. 6. Brutality is not honesty. The sixth boundary we need to draw is around something many of us were taught to accept as truth, the idea that harshness equals honesty. We're just being real with you. Someone had to tell you the truth. If we don't say it, who will? On the surface, it sounds noble, like they're doing us a favor. But if we pay attention to how we feel afterward, we start to notice a pattern. We don't walk away clearer, we walk away smaller. We've been conditioned to believe that if criticism comes from family, we have to take it. That if it's wrapped in, "I'm only saying this because I care," we're not allowed to question the tone, the timing, or the impact. So we swallow comments that cut deep about our body, our life choices, our relationships, our career, our personality. You've gained weight. You're not serious about life. No wonder people leave you. All of it presented as just the truth. But truth doesn't need to humiliate us to be real. Truth doesn't have to strip us of dignity to be honest. What we're actually experiencing in those moments is not honesty, it's aggression dressed up as concern. We can feel the difference in our body. Real honesty, even when it stings, lands with a kind of stability. It gives us something to work with. It might hurt, but there's a sense of, okay, I can use this. Brutality, on the other hand, leaves us shaky, ashamed, disconnected from ourselves. We don't feel guided, we feel attacked. That difference matters, and it's exactly where this boundary lives. Some families use "I'm blunt" as a free pass for cruelty. We're like this, we say things as they are. But if saying things as they are consistently leaves us feeling worthless, that's not culture, that's emotional laziness. It's easier to tear someone down than to speak with care. It's easier to dump frustration on us than to do the work of expressing it with respect. We're allowed to stop romanticizing that dynamic. Honesty becomes brutality when three things are missing: timing, intention, and respect. If someone chooses the moment we're most vulnerable to drop their truth, if their intention is to win an argument or reassert control, if their tone is laced with contempt. That's not them helping us grow. That's them using truth as a weapon. The boundary here is this. We will no longer accept attacks on our worth disguised as just being honest. Family does not get a special license to wound us more deeply and call it love. That doesn't mean we reject all feedback. We can still be open to hearing hard things. We need people who can lovingly challenge us, who can point out blind spots, who can say, "You're better than this," without tearing us apart. But there's a standard now, a line. We can start by checking in with ourselves after those conversations. Do we feel grounded or shattered? Do we feel seen, even if we were called out? Or do we feel labeled and reduced to our worst moments? Did they talk to us or at us? Did they speak from a place of, "I want to see you become your best," or from, "I need to remind you where you stand"? Once we see the pattern, we can respond differently. Maybe not with a big confrontation at first. Maybe it starts inside. The next time we hear, "I'm just being real," after something cruel, we can quietly correct it within ourselves. No. That was not honesty. That was disrespect. We stop internalizing every harsh sentence as truth and start filtering it through a new question. Is this said with care or with contempt? If it's contempt, we're allowed to detach from it emotionally, even if we can't fully avoid it yet in practice. Over time, we can begin to set more direct boundaries, changing the subject, ending the call, saying calmly, "I'm not okay with being spoken to like that," and not defending that sentence with a long explanation. We may hear, "You're too sensitive. You can't handle the truth." That's fine. Those lines are part of the script. But we're not obligated to keep playing our old role in it. Sensitivity is not weakness. It's awareness. It's our signal that something is off. And if our nervous system keeps ringing the alarm, the answer is not to turn the alarm off. The answer is to step out of the fire. We can still value honesty and reject humiliation. We can still desire growth and refuse emotional violence. These things are not mutually exclusive. In fact, the most powerful growth often comes from people who can look us in the eye and tell us the truth without stripping us of our worth. So the boundary is clear now. Love does not humiliate. Family does not get to crush our identity and call it being real. From this point on, we choose to separate truth from brutality. We choose to keep the first and walk away, internally or physically, from the second. Because our soul needs correction at times, yes, but it never needed to be broken to be guided. 7. Guilt as a control mechanism. The seventh boundary we need to draw is around the most quiet and effective tool many families use without even realizing it. Guilt. Not the healthy kind of guilt that wakes us up when we've actually hurt someone, but the manufactured kind. The kind that shows up not because we've done something wrong, but because we've done something different. We know this guilt by the way it speaks. It doesn't say, "You hurt me." It says, "I'm disappointed in you. After everything we did, you've changed." It doesn't confront our actions directly. It questions our character. It doesn't ask for a conversation. It puts us on trial. And the sentence is usually the same. "You are selfish for choosing yourself." When guilt is used as a control mechanism, it doesn't try to understand us. It tries to pull us back into compliance. We say no to a request that drains us, and suddenly the atmosphere shifts. Silence. Sighs. Stories about how other children do more. We decide not to share something personal, and we're told, "So now we're not good enough to know what's going on in your life." We choose a path they don't approve of, and we hear, "You've broken our heart." The message underneath is clear. If we don't behave according to their script, we're not just different, we're bad. This kind of guilt is powerful because it hooks directly into something we all want, to be good, to be loving, to be loyal, especially when it comes from people who raised us, people we once needed to please to feel safe. As children, we learned very quickly what made them proud and what made them hurt. And somewhere along the way, a part of us decided, their disappointment is dangerous. Avoid it at all costs. The problem is that if we never update that wiring, we'll keep letting their emotions dictate our entire life, even as adults. We'll say yes when every part of us wants to say no. We'll go places we don't want to go. Stay in roles that suffocate us. Answer calls we're not emotionally ready for. Not because it's right, but because we're terrified of that look, that tone, that heavy silence that says, "You've failed us." The boundary we need here is a deep internal one. We are no longer responsible for managing other people's emotional weather when we're not doing anything wrong. Their sadness, their disappointment, their discomfort with our boundaries, that belongs to them. Our job is to be honest and respectful, not to sacrifice our mental health to keep everyone else from ever feeling upset. That doesn't mean we become careless or cruel. It means we start measuring our choices by alignment, not by guilt level. We start asking different questions. Instead of, "Will this make them mad?" we ask, "Is this true to who I am?" Instead of, "How do I avoid making them sad?" we ask, "How do I avoid abandoning myself again?" And when guilt does show up, and it will, we begin to slow down and examine it. Did I actually do something hurtful? Or did I simply protect a boundary they don't like? If we genuinely acted out of selfishness or cruelty, then, yes, we repair. We apologize. We grow. But if all we did was say no to something that drained us, choose a different path, or refuse to be controlled, then the guilt we feel is not moral truth. It's conditioning. We're allowed to feel guilty and still keep the boundary anyway. That's one of the hardest parts of healing, learning that guilt is not always a signal to turn back. Sometimes it's just the echo of an old system losing its hold on us. We can begin responding differently, even in small ways. When someone says, "You've disappointed us," instead of instantly collapsing into apology, we can hold steady inside and think, "They're disappointed because I didn't obey, not because I did something wrong." We don't have to say that out loud, but we can let it shape how we feel about ourselves in that moment. Over time, we might also learn to speak more directly. "I understand you're upset. I still need to make this choice." Or, "I hear that you wish I'd done it differently, but this is what's right for me." No defense, no long essay, just calm clarity. And if the emotional theater continues, tears, silence, accusations, we remember, I can care about how they feel without surrendering my entire life to their emotions. The boundary is this. We refuse to let guilt be the steering wheel of our life. We refuse to let disappointment be a weapon that keeps us small. We refuse to keep confusing emotional manipulation with love. We can love our family deeply and still say, "Your feelings are yours, my choices are mine." And from that place, something shifts. We stop organizing our existence around not upsetting people. We start organizing it around not abandoning ourselves. 8. Your life is not a redemption arc. The 8th boundary we need to draw is against one of the most invisible forms of pressure we carry from family, the expectation that our life is supposed to fix what broke in theirs. It rarely gets said directly, but we feel it in the way they talk about their past, in the way they react to our choices, in the way certain paths are praised and others are treated like betrayal. Somewhere under the surface lives a quiet message. Don't repeat our mistakes, redeem them. We can feel this most strongly when we choose something different from what they wanted for themselves. The parent who wanted to be a doctor pushes us toward medicine. The one who never left home wants us to stay close so their loneliness doesn't echo as loudly. The one who married too early wants us to do it right this time. The one who never chased a dream wants to live it indirectly through us. And slowly, without naming it, we stop living our own story and start performing in a sequel to theirs. It becomes clear in the language. Don't waste the opportunities we never had. You have to succeed where we failed. Our name must mean something through you. At first, this might sound like motivation. It might even feel flattering, like we're important, like our life matters. But if we're honest, there's a heaviness attached to it. Because now, every step we take isn't just about our joy, our truth, our growth. It's about carrying the emotional weight of everything they didn't get to be. That's where the boundary needs to go. We can honor their story without turning our own into a correction of it. We can feel compassion for their regrets without allowing those regrets to script our future. Their unfulfilled dreams are real. Their pain is real. Their sacrifices, their missed chances, their what-ifs, all of it deserves empathy. But none of it is our responsibility to fix. We weren't brought into this world to complete someone else's arc. We weren't born as a second chance walking on two legs. Our existence is not an apology for their past or a patch for their wounds. When we let our choices be driven by the need to heal someone else's regrets, we don't escape pain. We just trade their sorrow for our resentment. We can see it in moments where we hesitate to choose what we truly want, because a voice inside whispers, "They'll be disappointed. This isn't the life they imagined for us." We might avoid a career we love because it doesn't look impressive enough on the family resume. We might stay in a relationship that doesn't fit us because it matches the story they wanted. Stability, respectability, the right image. Then we look up years later and realize we've lived a life that photographs well, but doesn't feel honest when we're alone. The shift begins when we quietly admit the truth. Their healing is not our job. Their unrealized dreams are not our assignment. Their narrative is theirs to process, grieve, and, if they choose, transform. Our responsibility is to live a life that is true to who we are, not one that makes their past easier to look at. That doesn't mean we dismiss everything they wanted for us. Sometimes their hopes overlap with what's genuinely good for us. The difference is in the source. Are we choosing something because it flows from our own values? Or because we're terrified of becoming another disappointment? Are we walking a path because it feels alive in our chest? Or because we're afraid of breaking their heart? We're allowed to step out of the storyline they've written in their head. We're allowed to choose a profession they don't fully understand, a place they never imagined us living, a pace of life that doesn't match their timeline. We're allowed to say, "I see what you wished for, and I still have to follow what's real for me." The boundary here is internal first. Every time we catch ourselves thinking, "I have to do this so they can be proud, so they don't feel like they failed," we pause and ask, what do we actually want? Separate from their expectations, separate from their pain. That question can feel selfish at first, especially if we were raised to live as extensions of the family. But in reality, it's the most honest question we can ask. When we stop treating our life as a redemption project, something gentle but powerful happens. We begin to see our parents and relatives as humans with their own unfinished stories, not directors of ours. We can love them, listen to them, learn from them, and still walk away from their script. We can carry their wisdom forward without carrying their unresolved guilt. We are not here to fix what they didn't fix. We are here to live fully what is in front of us. Our life is not chapter 2 of someone else's regrets. It's a book of its own. And we are allowed, fully allowed, to write it as ourselves. 9. The power of calm refusal. The ninth boundary we need to draw is around one of the simplest words we know, and the hardest one to say to family, no. Not the dramatic no, not the explosive no. The calm, steady, grounded no. The kind that doesn't shout, doesn't justify, doesn't build a courtroom speech to defend itself. Just a quiet line in the sand that says, we are no longer available for our own destruction. Most of us didn't grow up with this kind of no. We learned early that peace at home often depended on our compliance. Say yes, keep the mood light. Say yes, don't upset anyone. Say yes, and you're a good son, a good daughter, respectful, raised well. And if we ever dared to say no, the air got heavier, faces changed, the room went quiet. Suddenly we weren't just disagreeing, we were ungrateful, rude, too proud. Little by little, we trained ourselves to avoid that reaction at all costs, so we overcommitted. We agreed to conversations that drained us. We allowed comments that hurt us. We said yes to visits, favors, responsibilities, even financial burdens that we didn't have the capacity for, because somewhere inside, we were more afraid of their disappointment than of our own exhaustion. This is where calm refusal becomes an act of self-respect. The calm no is very different from the defensive one. Defensive no tries to convince them, I can't because I'm tired because I already did this and that. It piles on explanations, hoping that if we present enough evidence, they'll grant us permission to take care of ourselves. But that still puts them in the position of judge. They get to decide if our reasons are valid. A calm no is built on a different foundation. We are not asking anyone to approve our boundary. We're simply expressing it. We might say, no, I can't do that, and leave the sentence as it is. We might say, no, I won't be coming, without filling the silence with panic and over-justification. The power isn't in the word itself. It's in the energy behind it. Quiet. Unmoved, not harsh, not apologetic, just clear. Of course, the first time we do this, the reaction might be intense. We may hear, so now you're too good for us. You've changed. This is what you've become. That's expected. Systems don't like losing control. When we've been the one who always bends, our shift into stillness will feel like rebellion to people who benefited from our flexibility. But our job in that moment is not to fix their feelings. It's to hold our ground without exploding. If we escalate, the focus becomes our tone, our anger, our disrespect. If we stay steady, the focus slowly returns to reality. We're simply making a choice about our own limits. Calm refusal is not cruelty. We're not punishing anyone. We're not trying to hurt, embarrass, or prove a point. We're simply saying, our energy is not infinite, our time is not endless, and our identity is not available for constant negotiation. Sometimes the most powerful thing we can do is offer no performance at all, no emotional theater, no back and forth wrestling match, just, no, I'm not doing that, and then letting the silence belong to them, not to us. Their discomfort is theirs to process. And beneath all the noise, something important starts to happen inside us. We begin to realize that we can survive their disappointment, that we don't crumble when someone is upset with us, that we can still be loving, still be present in the ways that are healthy, while refusing the requests that drain our soul. Over time, our nervous system starts to learn a new truth. Saying no does not equal exile. Saying no does not mean we've become bad, broken, or ungrateful. It simply means we're no longer willing to sacrifice our mental and emotional stability to keep every demand satisfied. So this boundary is simple and radical at the same time. We are allowed to say no to family without writing an essay to justify why. We are allowed to protect our time, our space, our mind, our body, with one small word spoken calmly. We can love them. We can still say no. If you're ready, the last boundary takes this even further. What happens when no is not enough, and the most loving thing we can do for ourselves is distance? 10. Strategic distance. The 10th boundary is the one we hope we never have to use, but for many of us, it's the one that saves us. Distance. Not the dramatic kind built on screaming matches and slammed doors, but the intentional kind. The kind that says, I can't keep standing this close to the fire and pretending I'm not burning. We're taught that staying close to family, no matter what, automatically equals loyalty, love, and good character. We hear, but they're your family, as if biology alone should override every emotional bruise, every repeated wound, every pattern that's slowly eroding our self-respect. And for a long time, we might believe it. So we stay, we endure, we tell ourselves, it's not that bad, even as our body keeps tightening before every visit, every call, every message. Strategic distance begins the moment we stop gaslighting ourselves about how much something hurts. It's not betrayal to admit that certain dynamics are costing us too much. It's not cruelty to realize that being constantly available to people who repeatedly cross our boundaries is slowly killing our peace. Sometimes, the most honest sentence we can whisper to ourselves is, "I can love them. But I can't be this close to them and stay healthy." Distance doesn't always mean cutting off contact completely. Sometimes it's emotional distance, sharing less, reacting less, not letting every comment land inside our chest. Sometimes it's physical distance, shorter visits, fewer overnight stays, leaving when the energy shifts instead of staying to prove we're not sensitive. Sometimes it's time distance, taking longer breaks between interactions so our nervous system can breathe. This is why it's strategic. It's not about revenge, punishment, or making a point. It's about designing the amount of contact that allows us to remain grounded, sane, and true to ourselves. We might feel guilty just thinking about it. The old script shows up fast. You're abandoning them. You're breaking the family. You're ungrateful. But if we listen closely, we'll hear something else quietly rising under that guilt. Relief. The possibility of waking up one day and realizing we're not emotionally exhausted from fighting the same battles over and over. The possibility of remembering who we are when we're not constantly bracing for impact. Strategic distance is a boundary that says, proximity is not proof of love. Peace is. We can be in the same room and still be completely disconnected. We can also be in a different city, answering calls less often, and yet carry genuine care in our heart. Love is not measured in how much discomfort we can tolerate. It's measured in how honestly we can show up without losing ourselves. Sometimes, distance is the only thing that reveals the reality of the relationship. When we stop over-functioning, over-explaining, over-visiting, we see who reaches out with curiosity versus who reaches out with accusation. We see who can respect our space versus who panics the moment we're no longer constantly available. We see who wants relationship and who just wants control. We're allowed to create that space without making a dramatic announcement. We don't have to send a manifesto explaining every detail. We can simply start by honoring what our body has been telling us for years. If every interaction leaves us anxious, ashamed, or shattered, then we adjust the distance the way we'd adjust our hand from a hot stove. Not because we hate the stove, because we'd like to keep our skin. There will be people who call this selfish. There will be voices that say, family is everything. But here's the part no one likes to say out loud. If family is everything means we are nothing, then something is deeply wrong. And we are allowed to step back until we can exist as a whole person again, not just a role in someone else's drama. Strategic distance is not the opposite of love. Sometimes it is love for ourselves, and even in a strange way, for them. Because when we stop showing up as a resentful, depleted, hollow version of ourselves, we stop feeding the dysfunction. We stop pretending everything is fine. And from that truth, whether they ever accept it or not, we finally start living. So this last boundary is quiet but powerful. We give ourselves permission to step away as far as we need to, for as long as we need to heal what constant contact kept reopening. We can still wish them well. We can still answer if there is real emergency. We can still hold good memories in our heart. But we no longer sacrifice our mental health just to prove we are good family. Because in the end, protecting our soul is not betrayal. It's the first honest act of loyalty to the one person we are guaranteed to live with for the rest of our life, ourselves. There's a moment, somewhere in all of this, where we finally stop asking, am I a bad person for feeling this way about my family? And start asking a different question. How much of myself am I willing to lose to keep everyone else comfortable? Because that's what these boundaries are really about. Not rebellion, not disrespect, not turning cold. They're about ending a pattern we've been trapped in for years, the pattern of quietly abandoning ourselves in the name of love. The pattern of confusing ownership with care, guilt with loyalty, control with concern. Somewhere along the line, we learned that to be good, we had to be available, agreeable, and endlessly forgiving no matter the cost. And the cost has been high. Drawing these 10 lines is our way of saying the cost is too high now. We're not rejecting love. We're rejecting the versions of love that crush who we are. We're not turning our back on family. We're turning our back on manipulation, emotional debt, weaponized sacrifice, humiliation dressed as honesty, and guilt used as a leash. We're not becoming hard. We're becoming clear. Clear that our mind, our body, our time, our future, our emotional world belong to us first. Maybe a part of us is still shaking inside. Maybe we can already hear the arguments, the accusations, the familiar lines. You've changed. You think you're better than us. This is what you've become. And maybe for the first time, we're able to answer, if only silently. Yes, we have changed. We've stopped confusing losing ourselves with being loving. That's not arrogance. That's finally understanding that love, which requires our disappearance, is not love we can survive. From here on, we don't need to make a big announcement or burn everything down. We don't need to convince anyone that our boundaries are valid. We just live them. We speak less where it's not safe. We stop paying guilt invoices we never agreed to. We say no without an essay attached to it. We choose distance when closeness means constant harm. And we allow ourselves to carry both truths at once. We can love them, and we can love ourselves enough not to let them undo us. If there's one thing we take away from this, let it be this. Being a good son, daughter, sibling, or relative does not mean being endlessly available for our own erosion. Real loyalty starts with not betraying ourselves. Real love, even toward family, is only honest if we are still allowed to exist in it as a whole person, with a spine, with needs, with limits, with a life that is ours. So maybe tonight, or whenever this sinks in, we ask ourselves one quiet question: which boundary is our soul begging for first? Not all 10, just one. One line we know we've needed for a long time, but we're too afraid to draw. And then we start there, gently, calmly, without drama, but with a kind of inner firmness that says, "This is where I stop disappearing." We don't owe anyone our self-destruction. We owe ourselves the chance to live a life where love and dignity can exist in the same room. And from this point forward, that's the kind of life we're quietly choosing.